Martin Luther told an old story about a dog, and that dog was having like the best day of his life because he was running, but he had this massive steak in his mouth. So this dog is like, this is like an 10-mile day for a dog, and he's running, but he's got this steak in his mouth, and it's so incredible, but he's running, but he's actually running beside a river, and so he looks down and he sees another dog running beside him, also with a steak in his mouth. And he gets so excited, so envious of that steak in that other dog's mouth, that he opens his own mouth to bite the steak out of the other dog's mouth, and his own steak, of course, falls onto the ground, down the riverbank, slides into the river, is lost forever. Now, we're humans. We know that that's actually not another dog. That's a reflection of another dog, right? And so then the dog looks over, and he sees this other dog no longer has his steak in his mouth either. All is lost. And the point is that envy deprives us of appreciating what we already have. Envy, focusing too much on what other people have, more than on what we already have, deprives us in a multiplicity of ways, one of which is peace of mind. Roy Oswald says this, "The truly happy person is the one who wants more than anything else what he already has." Huh. This is a key idea today, and we're going to return to this a couple of times. The truly happy person is the one who wants more than anything else what he already has. And it's becoming harder and harder, I think, to live this way because we live in a time of more, 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 bigger, better, more. We're being promoted things all the time. We see advertisements in this culture nonstop. A scholar named Walter Harrelson writes, "Ours is an age in which the appetite for more and more seems almost impossible to assuage. We find it increasingly difficult to maintain any sense of balance regarding our use of food, gadgets for home, office, or auto, clothing, entertainments done in our behalf as we look on, or recreational goods and equipment." It is so, so very true. It seems to be getting harder and harder not to covet, not to envy. The truly happy person is the one who wants more than anything else what he already has. Well, I say this in the context of our current teaching series, which is the Royal Family Code. We are going through the Ten Commandments. We've been going through them one by one. Today is a bit of a different turn in that we're looking at two commandments, not one. And so we're going to look at commandment number 8, you shall not steal, and commandment number 10, you shall not covet. Now, next week, we're going to look back at commandment number 9, and then the week after that, we're going to bring it all together with some summary and some big picture insights. But here's why this is of particular interest to us, I think. We want to be content as people. We want to be happy. Now, we know that life is challenging, and are we going to be happy all the time? No. Are we going to be content all the time? No, that's just not realistic. But we like it when we are happy and content, and wouldn't it be great if we could expand our own happiness and contentment in the context of faithfulness on the narrow path? Ironically, focusing too much on what other people have and never on your own blessings actually steals something from you. It steals contentment and happiness and often peace of mind. So today is about refocusing our thoughts. It's about asking ourselves, can we want more than anything else what we already have? And so what we're going to do is we're going to go through a couple of passages. We're going to go through those two verses from Exodus 20. Then we are going to go through a short passage from Matthew 6 from Christ. We are going to go through a short passage from Philippians 4 from the Apostle Paul. We're going to summarize. We're going to bring together two applications for our lives today. And in one of them, I'm going to invite you to visualize what happiness and contentment might look like in your life while you store up not treasures on earth, but treasures in heaven while on earth. Okay, so let's begin with commandment number 8 from Exodus 20, verse 15. You shall not steal. Seems pretty straightforward. Here's a definition. Stealing is taking property that belongs to someone else, right? There's the basic definition. So, for example, let's say I go outside and my neighbor's got his car running in the driveway and it's a BMW. And I recognize that, you know, most people would rather have my van, my Honda Odyssey van, than a BMW, but let's just go ahead and say that, for example, let's say perhaps you might want to be, actually, we're so cool, we've got two vans. Laura and I are super cool these days. It's a phase of life we're in. But let's say, in some alternative universe, someone might actually prefer a BMW to the minivan. Well, let's say it's running, and I just get in there, I take it for myself. That is stealing, plain and simple. And so if you think of the original context, the Hebrews have come out of slavery as the slave people for over 400 years. They're in the wilderness. They have not yet got to Canaan. So this is foundational to a just and fair society. So it is very important that they self-regulate in this way because there is no police. There are no security guards. There's no digital surveillance. Like, we have a hard time living this out today in our culture. People are stealing stuff all the time, phones and cars and everything. It's like a problem. There's news stories about this, and we've got all those things. We've got police. We've got security guards. We have digital surveillance, and it's a problem for us. And so imagine how important this was for people to honestly live this way. Otherwise, you would descend into chaos. Now, today, there are additional considerations for us when we want to not steal. One of them is the idea of intellectual property. We are in a time where there is intellectual property. Let's say someone else has this copyrighted idea, something from a book, and I think, oh, that's a very clever thing to say. I want to use that in a sermon. Maybe it's Mr. Beast. Maybe it's J.K. Rowling. Maybe it's Oprah. Whoever it happens to be. And I take that as my own. That's a form of theft. What about music when we digitally take things, which we shouldn't. We download them illegally or use them illegally or a movie like that. That is a form of theft, and it happens quite regularly. One of the things we have to think about in worship, for example, even is we need a special license that we need to pay for so that we can project lyrics on a screen, so that we can use music, so that we can live stream it. There's an additional license that you need, and all of us, we do because we want to be doing things legally. Now, also, Christian history has considered something else, which we maybe don't often frequently associate with this. It's actually the exploitation of the poor. So when an employer does something to exploit their workers unfairly and they're depriving them economically of something that they should have, that is a kind of theft. Okay, so related to this is commandment number 10. Now, it's a little bit longer. Here it is. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, his male servant, his female servant, his ox or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. So clearly it's written primarily first to men as heads of household, but because we know of the wider scriptures, this is of course applicable to men and women, people of all ages. Now what's the definition? To desire or take pleasure in. To strongly desire or take pleasure in something. And the implication, because of the text, is desiring strongly, taking pleasure in something that belongs to someone else. Now, one of the things that makes this unique is that many of the commandments are about things that happen externally. They are actions, stuff that you do. Whereas this is internal. No one can know if you're coveting or not. But whereas stealing is an external action, coveting is an internal action, and this is consistent with the teaching of Jesus. So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, we looked at thou shalt not murder. And so Jesus says yes, but he also says you should not even be angry with the person in your heart. Last week, you should not commit adultery. Jesus says yes in the Sermon on the Mount, but anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And so Jesus is, in effect, saying that those things are the end result of a long line of thoughts and decisions, right, which go back to the heart. So he presses it deeper. He's looking to the root issue, deal with that. So here in the Ten Commandments, this heart issue is actually stated overtly. There was some research on different kinds of addictions. And people who are struggling with addiction, maybe it's alcohol, maybe it's drugs, maybe it's pornography, gambling, whatever it happens to be, if they vividly imagine themselves doing those things, it is very hard for them to resist because thinking about something causes you to want to actually act that way physically. And the same thing is happening with coveting. Deal with the heart issue so that we are not kind of taking the next step in our lives. Now, it's interesting that the same word for coveting appears earlier in the biblical narrative, way back in the Garden of Eden. So there's Adam, there's Eve, there's the serpent, right? We know this story. And the serpent says to Eve, hey, you should eat of the fruit of the tree because you will be like God. In verse 6 in chapter 3, we read this. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. The word desired is underlined because in Hebrew it's the same word for covet. She took of its fruit and ate. She also gave some to her husband who was with her and he ate. Notice the lie. The lie is, you're not good enough on your own. God doesn't really care about you. You need something else, even if that something else is something God says is not good for you. Now, in this list, when we look at the various things, we say wife, house, husband, animals, all that. I think it's important to notice that, of course, we live in a different time. You maybe don't have servants, but you might have employees. They kind of served a similar function. Maybe you don't have animals. Well, you might have a dog or a cat or something, but not in terms of a farm, although some of you are on farms. But more and more people would have had animals to transport them various places. So we could say cars. Sometimes people had animals do work for them. So we could think cars and technology. And then to just make sure that nothing is missed or anything, the text says, that belongs to your neighbor. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's probably harder for us today to not covet than it was for the ancient Hebrews several thousand years ago. Because we live in a culture where we're being, you know, pitched advertisements all the time, more actively. And I did an experiment several years ago. At that time, I was leading some monthly worship services at Woods Park, you know, the retirement home. And it's 6 kilometers from here to there. I said, okay, I'm going to just do a little experiment. I'm going to drive from here to there, and I'm going to see how many times I see an advertisement or hear an advertisement on the radio. There's only 6 kilometers. How many times am I pitched something? And the basic message of the vast majority of these advertisements were, you need our product, you need to give us money, and this will address a problem or something that is lacking in your own life. That's how advertising works. 6 kilometers, 67 advertisements over the course of 11 minutes. We are being pitched things all the time. We are being reminded of what we don't have and how our life would be better if we had all the other stuff that we currently don't have. Bernard of Clairvaux was a Cistercian monk who lived about 1,000 years ago. He says a helpful thing. He says this, trying to find happiness in the world is like watching a starving man trying to eat air. And by the world, he means, you know, things out there, the stuff. So imagine, is the hunger of a starving man going to be relieved by biting the air? Of course not. And the same principle is true here. We will not have our deepest desires satisfied if we are trying to invest overtly in the treasures of earth. Now, why would the Hebrews do these things, right? Okay, don't steal, don't covet. Okay, that's one thing. Okay, maybe we think it maybe makes sense on its own, private property. It would be not be a just and fair society. Things would descend into chaos. Maybe those things are self-evident. But what reason do they have to trust that God would provide for them? Because God is a provider. And so one of the things we've been talking about is how the commands aren't random. And we think they're just random commands. They're not. They reflect, among other things, the character of God. So you shall not murder. Well, because God is a life-giving God. And here's the same thing. Well, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. Why? Because our God is a provider. Perhaps the most famous verse in the Bible, finish it for me, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. That's right. Why? Because God is good at doing his job and providing for his people. So here we are at Exodus 20. Let's just see just what's happened in the chapters just leading up. What are the evidences? What are the reasons that they would have to trust him as a provider? Well, he's rescued them from slavery. That's pretty big. Chapters 7 to 15. He's provided manna and quail for them. He's provided for them physically and miraculously out of the sky. Exodus 16. He's provided water from a rock, for goodness sakes. Exodus 17. He's provided military victory against the bloodthirsty Amalekites. Exodus 17. Wow. All of this give us reasons to trust that God is a provider. So from here, we're going to jump to the New Testament. First of the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus' teachings, and why are we doing this? They provide us valuable pieces of perspective which will help us today keep Commandments 8 and 10. So Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, as always, gets to the literal heart of the matter. Here's what it says. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. It's as if Jesus is saying, why would you organize your life around things that don't really last? Imagine yourself at the gates of heaven, okay? You're at the gates of heaven, and you're having a conversation with Jesus, and he's like, hey, you did a great job of climbing the corporate ladder, but you really neglected all the things that matter most. how silly would we feel in that situation? And then he goes on to say, not only to not store up treasures on earth, but store up treasures in heaven. Well, what is that? Clearly we want to do that. What does that mean? Well, hold on. We're going to come back to that at the end. The second text is from the Apostle Paul, and it's from Philippians 4, beginning at verse 10. So as a reminder, we're doing this because these bits of text give us valuable insight, which will help us keep commands 8 and 10. Okay, so Paul, he's in prison, so he's not writing from an ivory tower, and he's talking about the strength of God and being content in all circumstances. And Paul has been through serious things. So in 2 Corinthians 11, we're reminded about some of his difficulty. He was what? He has been exposed to death. He's been flogged. He's been beaten with rods, pelted with stones, and shipwrecked 3 times. That's the guy who's saying what you're about to hear. He writes to them. He's writing to Philippians, Christians in Philippi. It's a young church. The paint is barely dry on the pews. They didn't have pews. You know what I mean? But he's writing to encourage them specifically about being faithful in the midst of hardship and persecution. He says, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. That is until now, verse 11. Not that I am speaking of being in need. For I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound, and in any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret to facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. Right? That key word, content. And I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Okay, so that key word is content. Now, when you make a list of Bible verses that are taken out of context, this is close to the top of the list, right? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So if you are, you know, putting in overtime at work to get some, you know, advance, but you're neglecting your family at home, but you're like, well, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, it's not really how it's meant to be used. If you're studying for your midterms and you want great marks and so you're cheating because you want the grades to get into your preferred university, well, I can do all things. No, that's misusing it, right? What is Paul actually saying here? He can be content, he is saying, even in situations of hardship and persecution. Why? Because God will strengthen him to do Jesus' work. So contentment is linked to doing Jesus' work in the world. He can be content because God will strengthen him as he honors the Lord in the world. Okay, so having said that, we're going to summarize before we apply directly. Here's a couple of summary points, just so we don't miss them. First, don't steal, don't covet. Hopefully that's obvious. This is foundational to a just and fair society. Plus, God is a provider. When we engage in stealing and coveting all the time, it's as if we're saying, I don't trust you, God, that you're going to do a good job in my life. You're not going to give me what I really need. Second, we are prioritizing things that last, not things that don't. This is at the heart of what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6. Treasures in heaven, not treasures on earth. How silly will it be if we make a bunch of decisions? Okay, sure, you make 10 extra grand, but you've neglected the grace and truth of Jesus in key stewardship areas in your life. Third, Paul taught us that we can be content even in situations of hardship and persecution because God will strengthen us to do Jesus' work. And so that contentment is linked to honoring God, and he will give us strength for that. And this causes us to kind of ask, whose kingdom am I here for? Am I here for my kingdom? Am I just building up my own kingdom? My kingdom come, my will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Or is it God's kingdom come, his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Albert Schweitzer was a doctor. He was a missionary as well. He erected hospitals in Africa. Not only he was an incredible musician, he could play Bach, and he would put on these concerts to raise money to fund the hospitals. He was asked to address the graduating class of Eton College. And this is what he says. Some of you may be actors, politicians, teachers, doctors, surgeons. But I do know this, the only ones among you who will be really happy are those who have sought and found how to serve. And later the students were asking him about his service and sacrifice, and he dismissed them, and he said this, it's actually not a matter of sacrifice, it's a matter of happiness. Happiness consists in service, in giving yourself here and now to that which is worthy and above your own self-interests. Wow, it's amazing. Now get this. So this is, I found this from a This is a government report from Australia. So it's non-religious. It's a government report about the future state of youth in the country. And I'm going to read it because I think it's amazing, and it could be equally as applicable to North America. Here's what it says. Robbed of a broader meaning to our lives, we appear to have entered an era of mass obsession, usually with ourselves, our appearance, our health and fitness, our work, our sex lives, our children's performance, our personal development. He goes on to say, it may be then, remember, this is not a sermon. This is a government report. It may be then the greatest wrong we are doing to our children is not the broken families or scarcity of jobs, but the creation of a culture that gives them nothing greater than themselves to believe in. No God, no king, no country. End quote. Wow. So again, to quickly summarize, don't steal, don't covet. It's foundational to a fair and just society. God provides. When we do those things, we are in effect saying to God, I don't think you're doing a good job. Two, as Jesus taught us, we prioritize things that last, not things that don't. Paul reminds us that we can be content even in situations of hardship and persecution, and that God will strengthen us as we do Jesus' work. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to apply these learnings even more directly to our lives. And again, I'm going to put up that quote because we're going to reflect on that. The truly happy person is the one who wants more than anything else what he already has. And I want to respond to some pushback. So my assumption is most people would probably generally agree with this, but some people maybe have some problems with it. And then address two of those possible issues. Some people might say this is a Western liberal democracy bias. That's what people in Western liberal democracies with full fridges say. And people in poorer countries, what about those? I would say that that idea is actually the bias. Because when you actually look at people in other countries, they are actually happier and content quite often than people in wealthier nations. There's statistics on this. So the assumption that they can only be happy and content if they have material goods in their lives, that's a false assumption that those things are directly related to happiness, which is not always true. You talk to people, you look at the research in some of those countries, and what we find is that quite often they're happier and content than people in wealthy nations. That's one thing I would say. The second thing I would say, there's some people who are dealing with really difficult things in their life, and they don't feel very happy in their situation because they have been wronged. They're suffering an injustice. And I recognize that, and I want to say that this quote really isn't about that. So if you're in a situation that is unhealthy, you want it to be healthier, absolutely. You're in a situation that is unsafe, you want to be out of that. You don't need to be thankful for an unsafe situation. I'm not saying that. This quote is about pushing back on the natural materialism of our time and focusing more on what other people have and not on God's blessings in our lives. So having said that, here are the two applications. The first is helpful from Gregory, who is a church father, 6th century. And he says this, you can tell how much you love something by the degree of sorrow you experience when you lose it. So again, we're not talking about people. We're talking about stuff and things. You can tell how much you love something by the degree of sorrow you experience when you lose it. So the application is we need to do some heart work. Maybe if there are physical things that we have in our lives that we just can't live without, then maybe we've got a coveting envy issue that we need to address. And so this is just about doing some heart work. Are my priorities the right priorities, or have things and stuff and accumulations and those types of achievements taken a disproportionate space in my life? The second is this. I'm going to invite you to visualize a future version of your life. Okay? So we're going to close with an experiment. And earlier I had said that Jesus said, don't store up treasures on earth, but store up treasures in heaven. Well, what is that? That sounds nice. We want to do that. What are the treasures in heaven? So what I did is I went through the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5, 6, 7, and I highlighted everything that Jesus said that was positive, things we should do and should focus on. Surely those are treasures in heaven that we pursue while on earth. And so I made a list of all of them. And what I'm going to ask you to do is close your eyes. Close your eyes for a moment. And I'm just going to say them, but I'd like you to imagine that I'm describing a future version of you, someone who is not distracted by lesser things, but you are actually this person pursuing the ways of Jesus in this world. Here it is. You being humble and pure in heart. You hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Showing mercy, making peace. Being persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Being the salt of the earth. Being the light of the world. You following God's commands. You resisting anger. You being faithful to one's spouse for those who are married. You keeping your word. You turning the other cheek. You providing for the physical needs of others. Going the extra mile. Loving your enemies. You praying for those who persecute you. Giving to the needy discreetly. You in prayer specifically for God's name to be revered as holy and for his kingdom to come. You practicing forgiveness. You fasting. You shunning worry, trusting God to provide. You seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. You not being unfairly judgmental, but someone who examines their own life and integrity first. You pursuing the things of God. You entering through the narrow gate. You being on guard against false prophets. You practicing authentic discipleship. You being wise, meaning you hear Jesus' words and freely put them into practice. And in addition to all of this, knowing that God through Jesus is in relationship with you, you have received the perfect gift of forgiveness and peace and reconciliation with your Father. He's given you his Holy Spirit, invited you to get in on the ways he is bringing heaven to earth. Open your eyes. Imagine that's a description of the future you. Storing up treasures in heaven while still on earth and finding contentment and actual happiness in the process. Now, I started with a dog story, so I want to end with a dog story as well. Fred Craddock's uncle adopted a dog, and it wasn't just an ordinary dog. It was a dog who had been at the racetrack, like a race dog, you know, those big, fast, muscular dogs. And those dogs, you know, they're all in these gates, and the gates open, there's a bell that goes off or something, and they're all chasing this fake rabbit that's going around. That's why they're running so fast. Now, why did he adopt this dog? Because the dog stopped running. Now, you can't have a conversation with a dog. And in his book, he kind of has this little fake conversation, but we can't really know what that conversation would be like. We'd like to ask our dogs about the weather and stuff, but we can't. But nevertheless, I wonder if the dog would have said this: I just woke up one day and realized that the rabbit I was chasing wasn't real. That story is really about people. What if we stopped chasing? What if we were storing up treasures from heaven while still on earth, which is the real key to contentment? Imagine that future you. We can do all these things through Christ who strengthens us. Praise be to God. Amen.